580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Come to you live today on WILL AM 580. One of the great stories of the last decade has been the emergence of the left blogosphere, the progressive blogosphere, the progressive media system to relative prominence. Today we're going to have two authors of a brand new book which chronicles that rise, discusses implications, and looks at the future. Our guests will be joining us, Jessica Clark and Tracy Van Slyke. But first, before we go to them, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Julius Genachowski announced a proposal to adopt a broadband policy framework that will promote universal internet access and protect net neutrality, the core principle that keeps the internet open and free from discrimination by service providers. The National Broadband Plan and net neutrality have been in jeopardy since a federal appeals court decision last month put the agency's authority over broadband in question. Genachowski wants to restore the status quo, reasserting the agency's jurisdiction by reclassifying the transmission of broadband back to pre-Bush-era treatment of broadband transport as a telecommunications service. The announcement was encouraging for public interest groups, but they cautioned that the FCC still needs to confront the issues of competition and affordability to ensure that America's broadband is as fast, affordable, and available as it is in other leading nations.
In public and non-commercial media gathered at the Federal Communications Commission last week to tackle some challenging questions about new journalism business models, new technologies, and the future of community media. Ernest Wilson, chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, spoke about the need to move beyond old ideas about our public broadcasting system.
Over the long term, our commitment must be to innovate for the American people, not to be committed only to one single application, nor to one single platform, nor to one single institution. Our fiduciary responsibility is to the American people.
Wilson said that the new public service media system must begin with what he called the three Ds.
The toughest part is accepting the notion that we have got to do digital, we've got to do dialogue, and we have got to do diversity, or we will fail our communities.
But there was a fourth D on everyone's mind: dollars. Free Press Managing Director Craig Aaron testified that just when the need for public media couldn't be bigger, we're spending far too little.
We now spend about $420 million per year in public money on public media. That works out to about $1.43 per capita. Canada spends $27 per capita. England spends $87. There are others who spend far more. I'd like us to imagine for just a second how the American public media system could dramatically increase its reach and its relevance with as little as $5 a person.
Annual appropriations for public broadcasting won't be enough to create the public media system we need, Aaron says. He's calling for a supplemental trust fund, seeded with a substantial endowment, that would allow the public media system to eventually become nearly or completely self-sufficient. Aaron presented several ideas on how to create such a trust fund. One was to ask commercial broadcasters to pay rent for their use of the public airwaves.
A modest spectrum fee of about 5% of station revenues on local broadcasters would generate about $1.8 billion per year, four times the current annual appropriation for public media. Put this money into a trust fund, and after 20 years, the public media system could be solely supported by interest with an annual budget approaching $2.5 billion.
Alternatively, Aaron suggests that by taxing 2% of the hundreds of billions of dollars spent annually on advertising, we could raise $45 billion for a public media trust in 10 years. Another idea is a consumer electronics tax. Consumers are expected to spend $166 billion this year.
Placing, say, a 1% assessment on the sale of electronic devices would cost the typical household about $15 per year, yet it would generate enough revenue to create a $20 billion trust.
Any of these proposals would take an act of Congress. But Aaron says that the best thing the FCC could do right now is to take the discussion about public media outside the Beltway and give local communities a chance to share their ideas. To read highlights of the testimony from the FCC workshop, go to newpublicmedia.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Today we've got a program I've been waiting for a long time. We have the authors of an exciting new book on the progressive media networks that have emerged in the past decade. Our guests are Jessica Clark and Tracy Van Slyke. Jessica is the research director at America University's Center for Social Media. Tracy Van Slyke is the director of the Media Consortium. Both of them used to work at the Chicago-based magazine In These Times. Jessica is executive editor, Tracy as publisher. And the book they've just authored and just published by New Press is Beyond the Echo Chamber, Reshaping Politics Through Network Progressive Media. Jessica and Tracy, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for having us, for sure.
Well, it's great to be here. First of all, let me start with you, Jessica, so we'll our listeners will know who they're listening to. Mm-hmm. Why this book? Why did you decide to do this book?
Well, we were really frustrated when we started writing this book because it was the middle of the Bush administration, and we really couldn't figure out why progressives couldn't get their perspectives heard. So, and there were lots of critiques and analyses of why conservatives had succeeded, and we wanted to really just get on the same page with everybody. So we literally did that. We created some maps looking at the way that the conservative noise machine was structured and the way that the progressive media network was structured. And at that point, there were a lot of gaps in that network. As we went on, the gaps started to close, and they started to close in ways that we hadn't really predicted. So we thought we needed a whole book in order to explain what was happening. And sure enough, it's been pretty complicated, and it was a very interesting process to document from 04 to 08.
And Tracy Van Slyke, why the title? What do you mean by, I mean, actually there's two components here, Beyond the Echo Chamber. What do you mean by the echo chamber? And secondly, Reshaping Politics Through Networked Progressive Media. And there's a lot loaded up into that subhead. But yeah. Let's start with echo chamber.
Okay, so echo chamber, I'm sure you've heard it, and I'm sure your listeners have too. There's a talking point on Fox News, and it's repeated over and over again by their hosts. And then you hear it on Rush Limbaugh, and then you hear it on a bunch of Congress members are repeating over and over again until it jumps what we call the species barrier and becomes sort of the accepted message or accepted story in the mainstream narrative. The echo chamber is what we're hearing repeated over and over and over again. And generally, those talking points or the stories that are deemed the most important stories of the day are decided upon by elites within the media system or within the political system. So that jumps us to reshaping politics through networked progressive media, where we want to move beyond the echo chamber and have everyday individuals and independent media network together, especially in this new online environment, to create and distribute those stories that will help drive them sort of bust through the echo chamber or circumvent around it to make an impact.
Well, let's start. I want to talk a little bit about both what networks mean for listeners who might not be exactly familiar with how you're using the term, and also the term progressive. And Jessica Clark, why don't you take one of those two and explain, you know, the importance of either networks or what you mean by progressive politics, and I'll let Tracy deal with the other.
Tracy, do you have a preference?
You go progressive, I'll go network.
Okay, so progressive is a term that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but during the period we cover in the book, it had a particular valence. And what it meant was that you weren't just a wimpy liberal, right, the way that this is one of the talking points that got disseminated through the Republican noise machine, where liberals are wimps, that you believed in progress for everybody, not just for yourself, not just for technology or something else, but progress, drawing from an earlier progressive movement. And it sort of marked a new generation of both political activists and media makers in this period. And so we saw the term start to seep into the broader political culture over that time. But it was a real marker, especially in the 04 election, for a new way of doing politics that was much more aggressive and networked and competitive with some of the more aggressive tactics of the Republican Party.
So, Jessica Clark, let me get this straight. Like, progressive includes liberals, it includes radicals, it includes socialists. Well, I mean, who's not a progressive?
Well, you know, I mean, it depends on who you ask. Actually, in the book, we've got there's a distinction between sort of emotional progressives and rational progressives. It's like one of these schisms that you see in these, you know, dynamic political movements. But I think it's, you know, it's something that you choose. It's a it's an elected identity. If you want to identify with this sort of new energy and the sense of momentum, and socialists, I would say, are farther to the left, and I'd say liberals are more to the center, but, you know, I mean, it's a little bit subjective. It's more about how do you create momentum around a political identity and a movement and really make an impact in the political scene in a way that maybe some of the more ideological, older party identifications had lost the ability to do.
Okay, now let's turn, Tracy Vanslyke, to networks, which play, they're in your subtitle, and they play a pretty large role in your argument in the book. Yeah. What do we mean by networks, and why are they important?
Well, when we look at the conservative infrastructure that they built up over the last 30 years, it's this very top-down, vertical, machine-like organization. So the question was, what do we need on the progressive side? We were not going to do that same top-down, homogenous talking points infrastructure. Progressives like debate way too much for that, which we appreciate, and diversity. So what was going to be the infrastructure, the grid work, if you will, that would support progressives? And so we talk about this in terms of the networked media environment, especially what we're seeing in the online media world now with these new social networking tools for the ability for individuals to connect one-on-one or in group settings with each other, as well as media makers, independent media makers, to connect with their audiences or potential new audiences to create and drive these stories out. So in the book, we literally lay out what we call four layers of networks, ranging from user networks, individual networks, where it's me and Jessica, we're both on Twitter or Facebook, and we really care about a particular issue. Well, we talk about how can media makers connect with those individuals one-on-one to help create and drive media into the system and into their own networks of peers. And then we add each layer on to self-organized networks. How do we, as media makers, connect with small groups of people who are online to identify stories and to create those stories, to pass those stories along, to take action? And then we move on to how do they work with nonprofits and advocacy groups? And ultimately, how do they work with other networks of media makers as well?
Our guests today on Media Matters, Tracy Vanslyke, you've just been listening to, and Jessica Clark. They're the co-authors of the brand new book, Beyond the Echo Chamber, Reshaping Politics Through Networked Progressive Media, just published by New Press. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for the authors, Jessica and Tracy, the telephone number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Jessica, if I understand the argument of the book and I hope I do, it is that, you know, the echo chamber, the conservative dominance of media was an important factor in their political successes, particularly in the first part of the last decade. And that then the argument of the book and the topic of the book is how progressives got their act more together. And a key part to the political victories of the Democrats and liberals and progressives in 2006 and 2008 owes to a smarter use of media. Is that correct?
That's right. And it's not an absolute. It's not like now progressives have won and they're going to dominate online media from here on out. It's a very competitive sort of arms race situation where new forms of media are coming along, new regulations, new platforms, and the different parties and the different movements are jumping ahead, trying to capitalize on those different spaces. So one of the reasons that conservatives were able to dominate in the last sort of battle was that they were ahead of the game in their investments and in their strategy on cable news and on talk radio. And then progressives came along, and there are people that say that maybe because Silicon Valley and some of the other technology spaces were more liberal, that they kind of saw the ball moving quicker, and they got, you know, they got into the game. So now the question is going to be, are the conservatives going to rally? And recent research, Yochai Benkler and some others did some recent research that actually showed that one of the reasons that the blue staters, that the netroots, were able to really have a much better impact is because their systems were more open, and they did bring more people in to have conversations, to make media, to be activists online. And so I don't know whether the conservatives are able to do that. It doesn't match their philosophy as well.
Well, let me just follow up with that with you, Tracy Vince. Like, I mean, to sort of a casual observer, it would seem that whatever setbacks the conservatives had from 2004 to 2008 due to the progressive, or for whatever reason, be it the progressive blogosphere, media, or whatever, they seem to have snapped out of their funk. Just casually looking at the progressive media, it seems like they spend an inordinate amount of time responding to Fox News, conservative commentators, who seem to still be very much as ever defining what everyone's talking about.
Yeah, I don't think in the book that we argue that because the progressives grew so much in the last couple of years that the conservative noise machine has been eradicated. In fact, they are still quite powerful.
Let me guess again. I mean, yeah. Arguably more powerful than ever, though? I mean, just looking at the last 18 months?
I don't know if they're more powerful than ever. What we're seeing is that they've jumped into the race on the online environment and are matching that up with their noise machine. And that is creating more momentum for them. What they now also have is sort of the unified anger front against the Democrats and the Obama administration that the left had over the last 8 years. So it feels like it's giving them more force. At the same time, for example, with the Tea Party movement, it's almost amazing to watch how the Tea Party movement and those groups have taken to the online environment almost sort of in the exact way that we lay out these network layers in our book. Not saying they read the book and got the message, but it's really interesting. At the same time, the Tea Partiers have an embedded media system, Fox News, that, say, the anti-war activists did not have over the last couple of years. So it's something that the progressives really do have to take note of. I still think there's some major opportunities for the left to continue to build its strength online. But, you know, in the book, we do talk about the lessons that we've learned over the last couple of years and how mm-hmm. to continue to apply that in the future, because if we don't, don't continue to innovate, we don't continue to experiment both with our journalism models and our strategic models online, we will fall way behind.
And you just touched, Tracy Vince, like on, I think, a really important issue, which is that Democrats are in power now, liberals theoretically are in power, the progressives have their candidates in Congress and in the White House, and that changes things dramatically. And Jessica Clark, I mean, one of the areas where that does change is like you don't have that unified voice as much as you had when you were in opposition to Republicans. And it can't help but jump out to me as I look at a lot of the progressive media you talk about in the book, and we're going to go through it in the program, that, you know, had a Republican president, say John McCain, been elected, and he increased the troop levels in Afghanistan as much as President Obama has done, you know, that this would be an obsession.
Right.
And everybody would be talking about it. It'd be just, you know, simply an outrage. And we'd be protesting and hunger strikes. People would be burning themselves up and jumping up around. And this is the worst thing ever. And I cruise the blogosphere constantly, the progressive blogosphere. And there is some discussion and criticism of it. But for the most part, it's just not even talked about.
Yeah, I think people don't quite know how to position themselves when the enemy is not as visible. You know, it's very easy to get excited about a Sarah Palin, for example. Like, that'll get you out of bed in the morning. But I think that not having such concentrated fervor has, you know, cooled down the fires of some of the progressive media makers. And also they're leery of, you know, attacking Obama when they know that they might be sort of piling on with people that they don't agree with otherwise.
Oh, this is Tracy. I would just also take a different angle as well. When they're not always fighting against something, but there's been an intense amount of passion and even debate within the progressive media system around fighting for health care, for example. Like, that was an 8-month, year-long fight where 80-90% of a lot of people's energy was going to fighting for something, and exactly what was that going to be?
That's a different challenge.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think, you know, you're almost splitting in two, in some ways, those that energy.
Well, Tracy, how do you think, that's a really excellent point you raise. How do you think, now, this happened after the book was finished and was you were going to press, but how do you think the progressive media contributed to and influenced the shape of the final health care bill that President Obama signed into law?
Oh, I think, well, two things. One, I think we saw, first of all, the first real test of sort of the ground relationships that had been built over the last 4 years among both the progressive sort of traditional media makers and the progressive blogosphere that had really risen in the ranks over the last 4 to 6 years. So there was some real testing of relationships, a lot more sort of infighting and picking on each other, philosophical disagreements. But what I do think it did is it continued to put pressure on the Obama administration and Congress to not cave. While the progressives and left did not get everything they wanted, without the progressive media system, I think we would have seen a much different health care bill or no health care bill whatsoever. At the same time, while you know, the public option did not come into play, because of the progressive blogosphere and its allies, you almost saw that die really early on, and they revived it and kept it in the sort of the mainstream media narrative for quite a bit longer, which I think also helped influence the ultimate outcome of the bill. So I think it was a real first test case, and there were some real victories, but there's also things that need to be learned and built upon from that big campaign.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Coming to you live today. Our guests on the phone lines with us are Jessica Clark and Tracy Van Slyke, the co-authors of the brand new book, Beyond the Echo Chamber, Reshaping Politics Through Networked Progressive Media, just released by New Press. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for the authors, the telephone number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. In the book, there's a long discussion of many of the success stories and developments in progressive media in the last decade. And I'd like to talk a little bit about them, get your assessment of them and where they are today. And the first one I'd like to talk about, and I'll turn to you, Jessica, is Air America, which is probably the most well-known example of sort of an effort to counteract the conservative echo chamber.
Yeah, I think part of the problem was that they were trying to build a parallel echo chamber. And this is one of the things that we realized as we were writing the book, is that you shouldn't be trying to match conservatives, you know, dollar for dollar and station.
Well, let me back you up if I can, Jessica, for people who might not be that familiar with Air America. Just explain what it was and why it came about, and then explain what happened.
So there was a big impetus in the beginning, near 2000 and around that time, to try to build a parallel infrastructure, a media infrastructure. And Air America was a national radio network designed to use humor and some of the sort of prodding tactics that the right-wing shock jocks had succeeded with, and to penetrate all kinds of local radio markets that didn't have any progressive options on the dial. And also, increasingly, as time went on, to go online and serve as a source for online audio and to develop pundits.
And especially they started off with a bunch of comedians, pundits that could make their way into the cable news environment, could become talking heads in the same way that a lot of conservatives have done. So over the course of its trajectory, it had several owners. There was even a documentary about how fraught its business plan was, and lots of different choices were made, some of which were not so hot, like to put Jerry Springer and Montel Williams on there. I thought that wasn't such a great idea. But one thing that was really interesting about it is that it did generate a lot of notice for certain people who then made their way out into the broader media sphere and became what we call high-impact individuals, like Rachel Maddow. She's probably the signature success story of Air America.
Well, or there's a senator from somewhere like Minnesota.
Yeah, Al Franken, something like him, yeah.
No, I think you're right. It actually, despite its travails, has, I think, had extraordinary impact for its brief history. Our guests again, Clark and Van Slyke. You just listened to Jessica Clark. Let's go to our phone lines now for our first caller to our guest. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have really grown to enjoy watching free speech television. Unfortunately, it's only available around here through satellite, so people who have cable can't get it. And it's also sort of ghettoized to the four-digit number realm, which is, you know, probably most people don't ever dial up that high. And if they don't know about it, they're, you know, going to have a hard time finding out about it. But it seems like if somehow that model could be gotten down into, you know, the part of the media that, you know, at least has the you know, range or getting to the audience that the other, you know, sort of network cable people get, that they probably could get more funding themselves. And, I mean, I think they do a pretty good job with the minuscule, you know, amount of money they have to work with. But they could, you know, I think be a real positive force. And I'm just wondering what your take is on that.
Well, this is Tracy. I actually work with my organization, the Media Consortium. I work very closely with Free Speech TV. And we are actually working with them, going to work with them this year on how to support and build out their online work. And I know Free Speech TV has been putting a ton of effort and energy into sort of reconfiguring their online strategy so they're not just relegated to the high numbers on the Dish Network.
Hey, Tracy, let me interrupt you for 1 second, because I think that there's probably 98% of our listening audience has no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, okay, yeah.
What is Link TV? What's Free Speech TV? What's on it? And then maybe talk a little about Link TV, which I think is related to it.
Okay, so Free Speech TV is probably one of the most well-known sort of television destinations for progressives and liberals. And it's based in Colorado, but it's national. And it does lots of things. It airs the television version of Democracy Now! It's sort of the prime supporter of Laura Flanders' television show, Grit TV.
And Laura will be our guest, I might add, next week, week from today,
perfect,
on the show.
Right. Okay, perfect synchronicity. Anyways, they also have a lot of different sort of talk shows from different sort of liberal experts or people in the communities. They show a lot of different video from different events and what's happening around the country. They're a great sort of hub, a television hub for liberal and progressive television media. Link TV is sort of the international version of Free Speech TV, where they do a fabulous job both creating and compiling international news and connecting from documentaries to different sort of Arab television shows, news shows, and so forth. So they're a great complementary effort with each other.
And these are both primarily available through the satellite systems, Dish TV and DirecTV?
Yeah, Dish TV and DirecTV, but they are also starting to pump a lot of stuff out online. Link TV is, I think, doing a really great job in terms of trying to interact with their community.
Now, one of the issues that comes up in the book, and that I think comes up, Tracy, in your work with the Media Consortium constantly, it's the overriding concern, is how do you pay for this stuff? Where do groups like Free Speech Television, Link TV, raise the money to put on a quality signal?
Let me inter- interject for a second?
Okay, go ahead.
Both of them are part of, the reason they're up in the high numbers is because they're part of nonprofit set-aside channels in the satellite system.
Mm-hmm.
So the government, as part of this spectrum trade for being able to broadcast across the satellite companies had to set aside certain nonprofit channels, but they relegate them. That the cable access channels are relegated to the margins in the cable system. So part of the broadcast is subsidized by their ability to be nonprofit, but that can also lead to some business model questions.
You know, Jess, we've got a really poor connection with you. Are you on a cell phone by chance? I can't even hear you at this point.
Okay. There you are. Much better.
I'll go farther.
Yeah, I think we're losing you, Jessica, unfortunately. I think we're going to have to talk to Tracy, and hopefully you can get on a landline or find some better location in the meantime.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's go back to our phone lines, and let me say to our listeners, you're listening to Jessica Clark and Tracy Van Slyke, the authors of Beyond the Echo Chamber, Reshaping Politics Through Network Progressive Media. If you'd like to call in, the number here, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go now to line four, Coles County. You're on the air.
Yes, I disagree with some of this. I've been very perturbed over the past year or so. Because as far as I'm concerned, the left in general seems to be quite dormant over the past year, and in general, and I see very, very, very little activity on the part of a lot of activity on the right wing, of course, not only the Tea Parties, but many others, very little activity on the left. These left-wing blogs are fine. It's a good thing to have, but let's keep in mind, when you post on left-wing blogs, you're talking to the choir. That's all fine and good, but there has to be a way to reach out to the general public and not just to talk to the choir. In my opinion, most leftists seem almost like they've given up. And what little activity comes from the left is, you know, there is a little bit of attack on Obama, but I don't think that's nearly as important to attack Obama as it is to attack right-wingers and what they're trying to pull. So I guess that's it. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And this is actually an issue you take up in the book. So, Tracy, why don't you try to field that one?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different sort of embedded things in there I'd like to address. One is I do think after President Obama was elected, there was sort of a big sigh of relief. and we see this often happen in sort of in the cycles of when Democrats sort of take power or get elected to majority. There's a big step back, like, okay, we did our job. Well, we need to learn that that's not the case, that we need to keep fighting. I think the rise of the Tea Party movement has also been sort of a stark reminder for us that as important as I do think the online environment is, we cannot forget what it takes to actually keep things moving on the ground. In terms of online or on the ground organizing is incredibly important. That has to be matched up with the online movement. So I can understand where some people would say, well, I'm not feeling it because if it's not in their community, then it's hard to connect with. But I do want to sort of take issue with sort of the preaching to the choir issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you have a chapter on that in the book.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to dismiss the notion that preaching to the choir is a bad thing. What do we think the right did for the last 30 years? That is incredibly important. Second of all, the choir assumes that everyone is on the same page. When we see within sort of the progressive movement ranging from more conservative Democrats to more socialists, there's a whole wide range of ideological and political views about where we need to take this country. So there's already arguments to be dealt with within the choir. The third level of it is that it's not just about talking to them. It's about assembling the choir and actually moving them to action. In the book, we have a chapter actually called Assembling the Progressive Choir, and it tracks the growth and movement of a blog called Fire Dog Lake, which has done an amazing job of combining both what we call great acts of journalism, doing good journalism, but it's not their full-time gig, with analysis and blogging, actual relationship building with their community, that then sets the stage for them to help their community take action, whether it's online, donating to different political campaigns, or to help Fire Dog Lake doing certain kinds of reporting, or to take action in different campaigns around, say, the health care bill, or to go support a senator or someone running for Congress, and actually getting people in one state to go volunteer in another state. So I think that's an incredibly powerful tool, and this goes back to the network layers that we're talking about, of how do you actually build these networks, these puzzle pieces online, and move that into the real world as well.
Well, let's go back.
Can you hear me, Bob?
Yes. I can hear you now. Is that Jessica, is that you?
Yes.
Well, let's go back to the phone line right now. We have a caller who's been waiting patiently. Again, our guests are Jessica Clark and Tracy Van Slyke, the co-authors of Beyond the Echo Chamber. This is Bob McChesney in Media Matters. Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go now to line one, Brooke, Indiana. Yes, Brooke, Indiana, are you there? Well, I guess
they waited too long.
I guess we waited too long, and I apologize for that. You know, I want to follow up on the last questioner's point, and I got to it earlier, and I don't want to beat this drum too much because there's so much material in this book. But it does seem that, you know, you said earlier, I think, Tracy, that, you know, the right wing has learned how to do the same stuff that liberals and progressives did from 2004 to 2008. And in the book, there's a lot of talk about how with the decline of traditional or what you call legacy news media, all these new social networks and phenomenal opportunities for progressives. But again, to follow up on the last caller's point, it seems like the opportunities are every bit as great and maybe capitalized upon even more by the right than the left. It's sort of, rather than being a hopeful view, it's sort of a desperate view we could take.
Well, I think that part of what we outline in the book is that not every media maker and not every media outlet has the same role to play.
Mm-hmm.
And in a period of, entrenchment, when you're not in power, the biggest role that rises to the forefront is the fighting the right, telling the wrong, keeping on them, refuting everything. In a period when maybe there's more power and you have the ability to get things done, I think some of the energy moves to more of an organizing model. How do we create things? How do we work together to construct policies that can actually be enacted in this environment? And it's not nearly as sexy. It doesn't generate as much news. You know, it's arcane. But that's where I see a lot of my friends and allies putting their energy is, okay, we've been saying that these things need to happen. Let's make them happen in the legislation. Let's make them happen by putting sort of strategic pressure on particular Congress people, and I think because people get a lot of their sense of what's going on, you know, from the headlines or from what's the conflict of the day, it doesn't necessarily lend itself to as much coverage. But I'm feeling pretty hopeful. I feel like I've got good allies in the movement that I'm a part of, which is the media reform movement, and that things are starting to, you know, the things that were frozen for a long time, the ice is starting to crack.
Well, one of the things you talk about in the book, Jessica and Tracy, is the way that the progressive media have teamed up and worked with activists and activist organizations to push issues that were getting neglected in the mainstream media, and certainly the right-wing echo chamber wasn't really aggressively pushing by any stretch of the imagination. And maybe you could talk a little bit about a couple of those. Let's start with one, which is the whole network neutrality campaign. And either one of you can take that. Who cares?
Jess, you go for it. Since you're
so right. Actually, that's cut off.
Hello.
Oh,
sorry.
There you go.
That's coming back around right now because there was a recent court decision basically saying that the FCC didn't have the ability to regulate the telecom company.
Indeed.
A real flashpoint. For activists to come back together around this issue. And the activist constellation involves reporters, policy folks, people who are working online, a whole constellation of people who can both talk at a very high level about these issues and then popularize the issue and get support from the grassroots.
Jess, maybe it would be helpful if you explain net neutrality, although I'm sure Bob has explained it many times to his audiences, and then
no,
like what happened.
Or that's a great idea. Jess, what is network neutrality, and you know, why is this important?
It's important because if we don't have network neutrality principles enforced, telecom companies can charge people who are providing information more. And those of us who can't afford to transmit our videos or our blogs or our nonprofit strategic communications plans over the Internet. Right now, there's an even playing field. Everybody can enter the Internet. The bar is low, and information can be transmitted. If there start to become these toll roads on the information superhighway, then we'll have a repeat of what we saw in the broadcast environment, which is there are gatekeepers, there are haves and have-nots, and the information system becomes much more segmented.
So obviously, network neutrality is sort of foundational to everything you write about with Network Progressive Media.
Yeah, exactly. You couldn't have had all of these folks come in as bloggers or working on new social media platforms and sharing information and influencing reporting if they had to pay a fee.
You know, we are being flooded with phone calls, I'm glad to say, for Jessica Clark and Tracy Van Slyke. So before we go any further into that story, let's get back to the phone lines and give our callers a chance to participate. If you want to join them, the number again, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's try Brooke, Indiana again, now on line 4. You're on the air with Clark and Van Slyke.
Yes, can you hear me, sir?
Yes, we can.
We can hear you.
Okay, great. I really am enthusiastic about what the authors are saying, but I have to say in comment, I was part of a group called Serious Change a couple of years ago, and what we did was dressed up well, made sure our hair was cut short, and went out to the protest where sometimes people are perhaps a little over-exuberant, and tried to make a difference there, and we got several things published online, and we got some good newspaper out of it. But then, as the authors are saying, just as soon as it looked like Obama was going to get elected, everybody just kind of fell away.
So is this a true-false question, or you just want their comments? Or
I just want to say that what they're saying is correct, that once the election was over, everybody seemed to think that things were going to magically get better, and I don't think it actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. Let me follow up, if I can, on the point the caller makes with you, Tracy, because you've been talking about this, which is, you know, how much you suggested that a lot of this just comes when you're empowered, then it changes the dynamics altogether. And I think, you know, Jess has said the same thing. But how much is it that President Obama has just come in and pretty much threw a wet blanket on the progressives and said, you know, now you guys shut up. You know, I'm going to do my thing here, and I don't really need you.
I think Rahm Emanuel has played a large role in that. I think there's interesting dynamics. You know, I know the White House sort of has special briefings for progressive bloggers in the basement of the White House, which, you know, you didn't really see before. I mean, well, especially when President Bush was in power, but sort of that reaching out to the blogosphere. At the same time, you know, you hear President Obama saying over and over again to Congress people, you guys need to ignore the blogosphere, ignore them. So we're seeing sort of this push-pull relationship, and definitely when they are frustrated when the progressive left sort of doesn't come in line with their talking points and continues to push them, you know, more to the left or into a different position than they would like to be. But I think it's a healthy relationship to have that tension, both with, you know, traditional legacy journalists and the progressive media, ranging from groups like Mother Jones, The Nation, to blogs like Fire Dog Lake and Daily Coast. You don't need to necessarily be adversarial, but you need it to be a relationship that's holding each other to account and accountability.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to the phone lines now to line 1 now, LaSalle County. You're on the air with Jessica Clark and Tracy Van Slyke.
Thank you. I just have a quick question. Do you think that the Fairness Doctrine will ever be applied to regular broadcast media again? And that's it. Thank you.
And Jess, if you want to take that, maybe explain what the Fairness Doctrine was or is.
The Fairness Doctrine was a policy that said that it, as part of being able to use the spectrum, that broadcast companies had to ensure that there was equal opportunity for different perspectives to be aired. Bob, when was that struck down? I don't know the year.
Oh, back in the 80s.
And there's been a lot of back and forth on whether it should be reinstated because of this argument about bias in the media. Depending on which perspective you come from, you argue it's because it's too conservative or too liberal. And I would say right now the conservatives are really flogging it as a way to position the FCC as a censor, and it's kind of a non-issue on the left. Not a lot of people are arguing for it because the broadcast environment is changing so rapidly, and there are so many other ways for people to have their voices heard. It just seems very hard to regulate and not necessarily the most productive point. You know, really, it would be better if it was just a more even distribution of money and argument and logic and facts on both sides. Unfortunately, we don't always see that.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our guests, Jessica Clark and Tracy Van Slyke, authors of Beyond the Echo Chamber. Let's go now to line two, Champaign County. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Rahm Emanuel for mayor of Chicago. Maybe we can get him out of the White House. Network neutrality, I think it's important, and you can do a better job than this than I, Bob. The FCC under Bush changed its category. I guess they no longer look at it as a common carrier, but I think it's important to point out that they specifically changed the categorization of the Internet so that the FCC would have less standing to control corporate dominance. But what I wanted to ask about was how do you treat the grandmother of Community Radio Pacifica in your text and also the more recent IMC phenomena and, I don't know, info shops and all that blooming. As far as the idea that the left isn't doing anything, it's really a figment of the I agree it's true to some extent, but there is the argument to be made that the echo chamber just locks it out. I mean, when you have 2,000 teacup people getting all this press, and when Jobs with Justice does a mobilization across the country that mobilizes five or six times as many of that people, there's just no coverage. So, I mean, it's not a big surprise that the anti-corporate stories don't get much coverage when the anti-government ones do. So I'll leave it up in the air and listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Let's see, Tracy, you want to start off and talk about Pacifica and the Indie Media Center?
Yeah, I mean, we talk a little bit about them. I mean, we think Pacifica and the Indie Media Networks are incredibly important. They are not a huge focus in the book because we're more looking at sort of the burgeoning online media environment and how there's new media organizations appearing online and how some of the legacy media outlets like Mother Jones have evolved to work more effectively online. But we don't dismiss their importance in any way. I mean, obviously, Democracy Now! Being sort of the flagship anchor show for Pacifica and a lot of different local radio shows are incredibly important, as well as the IMCs. In terms of, once again, sort of going back to, the corporate media not covering the anti-corporate stories, absolutely. I think, that's nothing new. What's exciting, though, and we see and we document in the book, is how sometimes you don't need the corporate media system or you use the online media environment so effectively that it sort of forces the corporate media system to respond. For example, in the book, we talk about the rise of a liberal news site / blog called Talking Points Memo, where they built a real relationship with their users on a regular basis, both talking with them on the website, comments, conversations, and combining that with really incredible investigative journalism. One of the prime examples is when a bunch of U.S. attorney generals were fired a couple years ago, and there was a couple of stories about it, but basically the corporate media system was ignoring the story, and definitely the right was trying to tamp down on it because there seemed to be political motivations behind those firings. Talking Points Memo really worked with its users around the country to sort of to take those local stories and create sort of the national story and combine that with their own investigative journalism, and they pounded on it so much, and they worked so closely. So many of the other blogosphere and other news sites picked up on it, once again going back to this networked media environment, that the story became so huge that the corporate media system could no longer ignore it. And that's one special case, but a great example. And a year or so later, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez had to resign.
You know, in the book, you have numerous charts, and you actually have been doing this for years, these brilliant charts sort of laying out all the players. And in one of them, your chart on the emerging progressive media network, your first number one is the not so big money for media. And this, of course, we've been talking about all these groups that have been doing progressive media. And, you know, and you know better than anyone, both of you from your day jobs, that these are groups that are all starved for money. And absolutely, many of these websites are talking like Fire Dog Lake are basically hand to mouth with one or two people. And, you know, the resources are fairly diminished. I mean, where is the money going to come from to give these media the sort of power that better funded corporate and or conservative media can have, or will it always be operating with, you know, a penny for every dollar the other side has?
Jess, I'll start and then you jump in. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay. Well, first of all, yeah, I mean, what we saw historically was while the right maybe had sort of less foundation or individual money for, you know, in general putting into media, they put a lot more of that smaller amount of money into media and messaging than the left did. So historically, we already had an imbalance. We also saw that the corporate media system had much more self-interest putting their money into the right-wing media system than the left did necessarily. Currently, the money is coming, especially if you're nonprofit, is coming from foundations still, individuals, for those that take advertising, from some amount of money from advertising, and still for a lot of legacy media from subscriptions, from magazines. They're struggling with the media, the business model as much as the traditional media system is, and everyone's having to tighten their belt. We're going to, you know, in a sort of weird way, the fact that the progressive media has been operating lean and mean for years is a good lesson. it's not as big of a shock maybe for these bigger traditional media environments. And what we're going to see is there's going to be no silver bullet that sort of creates the right business model. I like to call it a stew, which is funny for anyone that knows me. I never go in the kitchen. But, you know, you have to have sort of the right base stock of knowing what are the correct sort of revenue-generating opportunities. And then you're going to have to create your own recipe, your own spices that match to your model, that match to your audience and what they can help you do and support. And there's also new models that are coming up. And, Bobby, you've been talking a lot about sort of government support for journalism and so forth. So there's a lot of debates about what's going to be the right mixture of supporting journalism. Jess, you want to take
that? Yeah, Jess, do you want to add to that?
The thing that Tracy and I are working on next and that we've been studying in conjunction with the book and with our day jobs, my day job is about public media, is how do you define the impact of media?
Yeah.
Because part of what motivated conservative investors to put money into conservative media was that they saw the influence that what they term liberal media was having. That argument didn't make its way over to the other side. Foundations spend a lot more money on direct service than they do on sort of the ideological and idea generation side of the equation. So GFEM, Grantmakers and Film Electronic Media, recently came out with a report basically encouraging the foundations to network themselves in the same way that we write about in the book. And one of the things that they need to get their head straight on about is why are they funding media? What are the expected outcomes? And we'd say that a lot of these really line up with the traditional outcomes of journalism. You got to hold the powerful to account. You need to unveil corruption. you know, people need to know what's going on so that they can be informed citizens. All that seems really obvious to those of us who have spent our lives sort of fighting for that kind of journalism, but, you know, it needs to be matched to dollars.
And is there any grounds for optimism that at the foundation level that there will be a significant change in revenues or funding that goes to progressive or nonprofit media?
Well,
go ahead.
I would say that the recognition of supporting journalism in its broad spectrum, from both the actual production of it to the infrastructure to the media policy issues, foundations are turning their attention to a whole lot more. Some feel it's a little late, but we're going to take what we can get. At the same time, you start narrowing that playing field of foundations when you get to the more political atmosphere of progressive media, progressive journalism. That pool starts to get a bit smaller. And then you look at how foundations have been so terribly hurt in this economic period that they actually have less money to give. So while the urgency is really high, the money might be not matching up. So that's why, while we continue to work with and really want the foundations to get this, especially it's important to note that foundations sort of go in three-year cycles where they get very involved in an issue, and then 3 years later they may move on to another one. We need to sort of, A, convince them about the long-term importance of investing in both, you know, nonprofit and progressive journalism over the long haul, the way the right has done. But we also need more and more for our users, our audience, our community to become part of the media making system, whether it's working with these independent media makers, helping support them both in small and large dollars. That's going to be the critical combination.
Yeah, we've only got about 2 minutes left, and I'd like each of you to sort of talk about one example of progressive media in the last few years that's taken off that we haven't had a chance to mention that you write about in the book. Just to give listeners know what sort of interesting stories are out there they might not be familiar with. And Jessica, why don't you go first and just pick some sort of example of some, you know, successful developments that we haven't talked about yet.
Jess, you should do Brave New Films.
Yeah,
I'll do
that. So one of the most interesting trajectories that we trace is this trajectory of Brave New Films, which started out sort of in reaction to the Bush administration's war policies, making these long-form documentaries, and over the course of the 8 years, really learned how to do short-form viral videos.
And this is Robert Greenwald's operation.
Yeah. And so they started out with documentaries like Uncovered, and then they moved to much more of a campaign model. And they were really instrumental in breaking the story about how McCain didn't know how many houses he had. you know, and really pounding away.
Has he ever figured the answer to that? I've just
Seven, I think, was the ultimate answer, but, you know, give or take one or two.
Okay, yeah. I didn't win the office pool.
So I think that, you know, you can see them as kind of a key example of the way that communication has changed and become much more rapid fire, 24/7, targeted and networked.
And Tracy Van Slyke, do you have one you'd like to highlight before we close off?
I think it's both a highlight and a lesson that we still need to apply. We call this going beyond pale, male, and stale, mm-hmm. which we shortened to beyond PMS. Both things are very painful. But we talk about how the progressive media, within the progressive media, the rise of the black blogosphere, especially around the Jenna 6 incident when six black teenagers in Jenna, Louisiana, were accused of attempted murder. And the black blogosphere, with their allies like Color Change, really rallied thousands and thousands and thousands of people to come down to Jenna, Louisiana, and protest and donate a lot of money to support these teenagers. And we talked about the rise of the feminist blogosphere and how critical humor is to fight sort of the fear-mongering that the right does. But it's also a lesson, I think, that we really need to think about in terms of the changing demographics of this country, how the progressive media needs to both be much more diverse internally in terms of who's producing the media and how we are working and interacting with these diverse communities as well. Because
Tracy Van Slyke, I hear the band tuning up in the background,
okay.
Which means I've got to thank you and Jessica Clark for joining me today. It's been great. They are the authors of Beyond the Echo Chamber, Reshaping Politics Through Network Progressive Media. Jessica and Tracy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us, Bob.
And good luck with the book.
BeyondTheEcho.net.
Yes.
Yeah, BeyondTheEcho.net. And I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kyle Kroha, the engineer. I'm Bob McChesney, back in 167 hours with Laura Flanders. Everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today will be mostly sunny with a high around 60. Tonight, mostly cloudy skies with a low of 42. Monday, partly sunny, and there's a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon, the high 65. And Monday night, a 70% chance of precipitation, the low 52. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL.